Welcome to The Point on WCAI. I'm Steve Junker, speaking to you from my home in Woods Hole. It's Friday, June 5th, and this is our weekly local news roundup. We'll be discussing the week's top stories with colleagues in the print and digital media. Today on the program, we'll be hearing from WCAI's Jeanette Barnes and Eve Zuckoff. We'll speak with Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle, Alex Darris at the Provincetown Banner, and Jessica Hill at the Cape Cod Times. We'll check in with Josh Balling at the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror, Noah Asimo at the Vineyard Gazette, and we'll hear from Mike Dean up at the State House. A remarkable week for demonstrations and protests across the region. Joining us to give a sense of how these took place and the local passion behind these rallies, we have WCAI's Jeanette Barnes. Good morning, Jeanette.
Good morning, Steve.
And we're also joined by WCAI's Eve Zuckoff. Hi, Eve.
Hi, Steve.
You were both out covering protests this week. I want to talk about what you heard and saw. Let's start with Jeanette. On Wednesday, you went out to cover a protest in New Bedford. This was not a one-off demonstration in New Bedford.
Right. They've been out there every day since Saturday, and they were out again yesterday. Of course, they are addressing police brutality both nationally and sort of at home, because some of them are making references to a case in 2012 where there was a fatal police shooting of a teenager in New Bedford. One thing that was really striking about that demonstration, aside from the number of days, now they say they're going to be out there every day indefinitely at a major downtown corner. One thing that was really striking when I was there was the constant honks of support at this busy intersection from the cars going by. As I was trying to interview folks, we were like waiting for a little break in the sound, and we couldn't really even get one that lasted for more than a few minutes. Like a lot of the other demonstrations, this was organized mainly by young people, seems like in their 20s. They were passing around a bullhorn and leading the chants about the horns honking. I think they might have been a little disappointed at the head count there on Wednesday. It was mid-afternoon. It was about 70 people, but they've told me that it gets sort of to be a bigger crowd, you know, after people get out of work in the evening. So I was there at about 2:30 in the afternoon. Marcus Daniel Brito Barros is one of the young leaders. He's only 21, and he's from New Bedford. He was kind of telling the protesters, every honk is a support for the cause. They may not be here, but they're with us, and they're honking. So,
Eve, let me ask you. You were out at, I think, three different protests this week. Tell us where you were to start with.
That's right. So I started in Falmouth. There was a vigil in Falmouth over the weekend. And then there was a protest at the Mashpee Rotary on Wednesday. And then on Thursday, there was a protest in Buzzards Bay.
What was the crowd like at these different protests in terms of the makeup of the crowd that's there?
Yeah, I mean, it's a range, but I would say for the most part, the crowd itself is 80% to 90% white, and that's apparent in the signs that you see. There's people who have signs that say white silence is violence. There's so many signs, that homemade signs that say Black Lives Matter. And really, the mood has varied. In Falmouth, it was a vigil, so it was much more somber. But in Mashpee and Buzzards Bay, it was something a lot more similar to what Jeanette has described. You know, cars honking in Buzzards Bay, food, you know, pizza, gummy fruit snacks, water, Gatorade was being passed out. Protesters were playing music. Protesters even got in their car in Mashpee and Buzzards Bay, drove through the rally, through the Rotary, standing through the sunroof holding signs. So the makeup was really rooted in solidarity. I think that was the main thing there.
Jeanette, when you were there in New Bedford on Wednesday, what was the police presence like? Is it very low key, or are they working together with demonstrators? Did you get a sense of that?
The police presence was very low-key. When I was there, actually, I arrived and I didn't see any police initially. And then I was sort of lucky because the chief rolled up in his vehicle to talk to some of the leaders. So I got to talk to the chief. And then after a little bit of talking to some people, he left. So I didn't see any police, like, completely monitoring the situation the whole time. I think as it gets to evening and dusk, that changes, you know, because I've seen photos from some of the other media outlets of the police being on the streets at night. And then also this group, they gather at 11:30 every morning at the corner of County and Union Streets. And they're there for several hours doing the demonstration, the signs and the chanting. And then they march somewhere. So they've chosen a few different destinations. And I think that might be when the police are paying closer attention later in the day.
Eve, how about you at the three different demonstrations you went to? What kind of sense did you get about concern from the police about safety issues?
Yeah, it's a range. So in Mashpee, there were two officers monitoring the event. They told me they were on bikes. It was only two of them to a crowd of at least, I would say, 500 or so. They said they were just there to make sure no one got hit by a car or anything trying to cross over into the Rotary. But that wasn't the case in Buzzards Bay. In Buzzards Bay, there were four police officers really there with protesters. They said that Chief Dennis Woodside, Chief of Police in Bourne, said, what happened to George Floyd, you know, the black man whose death started all of this, was, he described it as horrible. He said, we're here not for crowd control. We're here to stand with the crowd. We're concerned about, you know, non-affiliated protesters coming in and inciting, you know, igniting the situation. But for the most part, they were there in support, was what they told me.
And what's your sense of the energy at these events that you were at, Eve? Are they upbeat? Are they angry? Mournful, obviously, marking the death of George Floyd at the hands of Minneapolis police, but it's really turned into such a big movement. Is there a sense of that?
Absolutely. There's a sense of urgency at each of them. So whether you're taking 15 minutes of silence in Falmouth or you're, you know, cheering to cars honking around a Rotary, there's urgency no matter what. But I think that mood, whether at the heart of it it's more somber, more playful, especially because in Buzzards Bay the rally was organized by teenagers, so there's a huge teen presence there. There's also honestly a little bit of lightness. There are a lot of people who haven't seen friends in a long time. They're gathering for the first time to be together in this really united way. And there's so much excited greeting of one another. That really struck me. You know, there's mask wearing to be mindful of the COVID-19 crisis, but people are really excited to be with each other.
Well, that brings me to one of the questions I wanted to ask, which is about this pandemic. What's your perception of how people are handling this? Jeanette, when you were in New Bedford, did you get a sense, are people still mindful of the pandemic? Are they wearing masks or do they talk about it? And as Eve said, does it seem to amplify this energy of people being together after all this time of enforced isolation?
Yeah, that was interesting. I would say the vast majority were wearing masks, but they weren't really separating from one another because they were all trying to stand at that visible corner. I wondered myself if some people felt more comfortable being out there because their face was partially covered. But people didn't really talk much about the pandemic itself, but most were wearing masks. One thing that I would say was just really almost like the key vibe in New Bedford was that they're united and upbeat. So they're chanting, "United we stand," but they're also challenging white people to make this about more than just a one-day demonstration. You know, they're all chanting, as apparently they also did on the Cape, "White silence equals violence." So, you know, it was a racially mixed crowd in New Bedford, and they're upbeat and united, but they're also challenging white people to do more.
We are going to be talking about protests throughout the program today as we go around the region. I want to pivot right now to another story that you covered this week, Jeanette. Under phase one of the pandemic reopening plan, stores are allowed curbside business. Some have interpreted that rather broadly. Jeanette, you visited a shopping plaza in Sandwich where boundaries are being pushed because of a perceived unfairness in the law. Tell us about this.
Yes. So this is really interesting. This is at a plaza in Sandwich called Merchant Square, which is near a big Stop and Shop. And the owner, there's a clothing store, There's a gift shop, there's a pet supply store, and a sort of cafe and coffee place. It seems the owner of the clothing company really kind of took it upon herself to say, look, I'm going into Walmart and people are buying clothes. People are buying anything they want, and I can't sell clothes, and that's unfair. And she posted a public Facebook video saying that she was going to be opening Fridays through Sundays with merchandise out on the sidewalk, and she would let one or two people in the store, she said in the video. Then by last Saturday, she was letting up to four people in the store. She actually had a little sign saying up to four people in the store at a time, which does contradict what the state has put out there for reopening rules. And she says that she encouraged her neighbors to open as well, the other stores. The gift shop opened, was letting people inside. The pet supply shop said they sell pet food, so they were allowed to open. And likewise, the cafe was allowed to be there for takeout. But some people definitely challenging the rules, and not without support from elsewhere in town as well, I would say.
And now these rules are due to be revised perhaps by the governor very shortly. A lot of these retail stores are waiting to see what the governor has to say about the next phase of the reopening. Is that right?
Right. So although this has been going on for at least two weekends already, that's true, that Monday is likely or possible that the governor could say phase two is beginning, and that customers, a limited number of customers with, you know, restrictions and whatnot, will be able to go into stores again. So they're just about at the moment where they're within the guidelines, but not quite.
And this was an issue we heard about when the phase one rules were put forward, that the Cape in particular is a region of many small businesses, and these businesses are a little bit, they're perhaps disproportionately impacted by the guidelines here, which allow big stores, like you say, like Walmart, which sells food, but everything else too, to be open during the pandemic. And these little stores are trying to eke through to an opening. And we heard from the delegation too, kind of trying to speak to this at one point earlier.
Right. That's true. And the director of the Sandwich Chamber of Commerce, Denise Dever, has really been pretty outspoken, saying that it's really not fair to small businesses the way this is happening. Also on the Cape, of course, we have sort of the seasonal nature of the high season. Even if businesses are open year-round, they're really dependent on business that's starting now, because they don't do as much business in the winter.
I want to turn to Eve here. Amid all the loud news about protests and the pandemic, a smaller milestone was reached on Nantucket. Eve, you covered this. Nantucket's ban of single-use plastics is officially underway. What does it mean for businesses and residents?
That's right. So it's businesses, it's restaurants, it's grocery stores, it's even residents. So there's a ban on commercial single-use petroleum-based plastic products. So that's things like plastic straws, drinking cups, lids, non-recyclable coffee pods, K-cups, even the kind of plastic webbing that goes between six-packs that you see, that can no longer be sold or distributed. But the town has been working for 2 years, since 2018, to really get up to this point with businesses. So they've been, really working on a public outreach campaign. And while in some ways this is a major milestone, in other ways, town manager Libby Gibson told me, because of the pressure that, as Jeanette is talking about, that the coronavirus pandemic has put on small businesses, they are not going to enforce this just yet, especially with just how much takeout is being relied on for so many businesses. They're going to kind of reevaluate in the fall how they can, create some penalties and really get into enforcing something like this to ease the pressure on the landfill on the island, just filling up and get rid of plastic that's covered, that's all over the beaches and on the roadside. So they want to get back to it, but understand that there's something else going on.
We are speaking with WCAI's Jeanette Barnes and Eve Zuckoff. Jeanette, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Steve.
And Eve, thanks for joining us this morning.
Thank you.
This is the News Roundup on The Point. We're talking about the top local stories of the week with colleagues in the print and digital media. I'm Steve Junker. Chatham is considering reworking its main street to allow for social distancing while promoting summer shopping and strolling. Tim Wood joins us from the Cape Cod Chronicle with that story. Hiya, Tim.
Good morning.
Tim, a number of other towns across the region are looking at similar measures. Tell us what Chatham has in mind and how they're working through this.
Sure. Now, given Chatham's narrow and uneven sidewalks in the downtown area, officials, you know, they're concerned, as you said, Steve, about the crowds this summer being able to socially distance and people feel safe to come downtown to shop. A group of business leaders came up with a plan that calls for a one-way pedestrian traffic sort of up heading east on one side and heading west on the other side between the Rotary and where School Street ends. And they also called for in that plan no on-street parking, which would provide a wider area for pedestrians to walk in, and perhaps even space for merchants to display items outside of their stores. There would be, under this plan, specific areas set aside for people to drop off passengers and to pick up takeout orders from restaurants and also shops. During discussions on this last week, the main concern was about this plan was safety. Basically, how to keep pedestrians from wandering into the travel lanes if there is no barrier between the pedestrian area and the roadway. You know, normally there'd be parked cars between the sidewalk and the travel lanes. If there are no parked cars there, and there's a lot of people and they want a distance, are they going to, you know, sort of stray into the travel lanes? There was also some opposition from some shop owners who felt that the plan would dissuade people from coming downtown because there wouldn't be parking on street. But there would still be plenty of parking in the parking lots that are just off Main Street. Now, as we all know, nobody's quite sure what kind of numbers we're going to see shopping in downtown Chatham and elsewhere on the Cape this summer. Especially with a lot of the major draws like band concerts and parades canceled. But officials want to make sure that the people who are here are safe and will feel safe to come downtown. As we talked about last week, the health board here put in an order requiring that everyone downtown wear masks. They actually extended that order this week to include the Fish Pier and Lighthouse Overlook. The plan for downtown is now being finalized and refined by a working group that includes members of the police department, merchants, fire department, and town planning staff. They're trying to hammer out the details. They met twice last week, once on Main Street, walking along the sidewalks to get a firsthand look at what this plan might look like. And they are expected to deliver their recommendations to the Board of Selectmen. As you can imagine, there's a lot of anxiety about getting something in place as people are already starting to come down.
Mm-hmm. That is Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle updating us on Chatham's plans for dealing with Main Street this summer. Tim, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Steve.
We just heard about Chatham. Provincetown has its own plan for making its Main Street more accommodating to social distancing. It involves eliminating traffic altogether, maybe, from the Provincetown banner. We're joined now by Alex Darris with a look at that. Hi, Alex.
Hi, Steve. Good morning.
Alex, this plan went into place last night as a kind of a test. Is that right? Tell us what's going on and what's the reaction to this.
Yeah, they're kind of doing a test run in town to close cars from Thursday through Sunday from 6 p.m. to 10 p.m.
Tell us what...
I think we've got
a poor connection with Alex. Alex, you're kind of cutting in and out. You want to try one more time? Tell us what they're doing there. We missed even the very beginning explanation of what's happening there with commercials.
Oh, I'm sorry. Can you hear me now?
I can, yes. Go ahead.
Okay. Yeah, so they're trying to close Commercial Street from Thursday through Sunday from 6 p.m. to 10 p.m. So far, it hasn't been too crazy since the weekend hasn't started, but this weekend it was supposed to be Pride in town, so it'll be interesting to see if people are still looking to come out and enjoy Provincetown and how they'll respond to not being able to drive down Commercial Street, obviously. And like you said, the whole idea is to really promote social distancing. Like, they're not really looking to have tables in the street or have selling merchandise in the road. They're really just trying to give people more room to be able to walk around.
Commercial Street is already a narrow street and seems like people pretty much just walk down the street much of the time anyway. But is this considered significant? They're taking the parking off the street too, is that right?
It would be closed, yes, from 6 p.m. to 10 p.m. So it would be significant, but it wouldn't be the full day. The idea is just because the weekend evenings get a little busier. And like you said, people, the sidewalks are also very narrow. So it's very difficult to have two people walking opposite ways. So just kind of opening up the street so people can try to achieve that 6-foot distance from one another.
And then at what point do they reevaluate this to decide whether this is something they want to do going through the summer?
The select board will have a meeting on Monday where they put it first on their agenda so people would be able to call at the beginning of the meeting and provide public comment, because there was some concern. They were initially going to try to just implement it starting this weekend, but they wanted to hear more from the residents and kind of give people a trial run to see like what they think about after actually experiencing being able to walk down the middle of the street without having cars. So,
Alex, I also want to ask you about the local demonstrations in support of Black Lives Matter in Provincetown, calling for racial justice. Tell us a little bit about what it's been like there in Provincetown.
Yeah, so it was pretty interesting because on Sunday there typically is a noise parade in town at 7 p.m. where people drive down the street and come out of their houses and yell in support of essential workers for coronavirus. So they decided this week that it would be some organizers in town a great idea to just host the protest during that time, since people were kind of used to already driving down the street. And they ended up gathering on the pier to have a vigil and say the names of some people who have been victims of police brutality. And overall, there was a really good response, especially because people were able to, if they did feel like uncomfortable leaving their homes, they were able to participate by driving down in the car and driving down Commercial Street, waving signs and honking their horns and stuff like that.
From the Provincetown Banner, that's Alex Darris. Alex, thanks for joining us with that.
Thank you, Steve.
Falmouth Hospital is going out of the business of delivering babies if it gets its way, but an online public hearing drew plenty of voices opposed to the idea. From the Cape Cod Times, Jessica Hill joins us with this story. Hi, Jessica.
Hi, how are you?
I am doing well. Thanks for joining us. Jessica, the hospital wants to shift maternity and some pediatric services down the road to Cape Cod Hospital. And tell us about this call and what it was for and what did they hear?
Right. So last week there was a public hearing in which Sherman Loans, who's the director of the State Department of Public Health's Bureau of Healthcare Safety and Quality, he led the hearing and heard from different nurses, public officials, and residents about their concerns for closing the maternity ward.
And it sounded like they heard a lot of concerns about these. Detail some of these concerns that people heard.
Right.
A lot of it has to do with access to care.
Right. So Dr. William Agle, who's an obstetrician at Cape Cod Hospital, was talking about how the Cape Cod Hospital is about 21 miles from Falmouth, and which is in range of the 50 miles and which is considered low access to care. However, many residents argued that although Cape Cod Hospital was within this 50-mile range, summer traffic or congestion could make the drive from Falmouth longer than an hour. Many nurses were talking about how there have been certain situations in which if a mother had to drive all the way to Cape Cod Hospital, the baby would have died or there'd be some severe complications. And then some other people were talking about how this would also kind of discourage young families from moving into the area. When maternity and pediatric units are closed, the community might become a geriatric community, one nurse argued.
Tell us what the hospital is saying about why they feel like they have to do this, essentially.
So the closure was attributed to, for many different reasons, declining birth rates. Last year, only 328 babies were born at Falmouth Hospital, which equals less than one birth per day. And then also, they've been having difficulty recruiting physicians to the hospital. And Michael Loss, he also argues that the proximity to Cape Cod Hospital makes it manageable for people to come to Cape Cod Hospital from Falmouth. And then while they were aware of all those downward trends with declining birth rates, the COVID-19 crisis kind of forced them to act a lot more quickly. They wanted to close those maternity units so in case a second surge of COVID-19 happens, as it's predicted in the fall, Falmouth Hospital would be able to help those people and be better prepared.
Now, even the Cape's delegation has weighed in here about this issue. Tell us a little what they say.
So Reps Sue Moran, David Vieira, and Dylan Fernandez wrote a statement in opposition to the closure. Sue Moran said that Falmouth Hospital may restrict access to care in what is already, you know, an underserved region of the Commonwealth, especially during the height of a global pandemic. She argues that many young families choose where to live based on the proximity to nearby hospitals. And she said that, furthermore, when you close those units, it'll dissuade young families from coming, but then further, it will have a negative impact on the local economy.
Is this a done deal?
It looks like it is most likely a done deal. However, within a couple of days, we should be hearing back from the Department of Public Health's Bureau of Healthcare Safety and Quality. If the department finds that these services are necessary, Cape Cod Healthcare must submit a plan within another 15 days that will ensure access. The state then has 10 days to approve the plan or give feedback that the hospital must address within another 10 days.
From the Cape Cod Times, Jessica Hill with that story. Jessica, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Nantucket saw protesters joining peacefully with others around the nation this week, calling for racial justice, commemorating the death of George Floyd. Josh Balling joins us from the Inquirer and Mirror. Hi, Josh.
Good morning.
Josh, Nantucket's demonstration had a strong youth component.
It definitely did. Several hundred islanders, most of them students at Nantucket High School and former students, gathered at Tom Nivers Field on Monday night to peacefully protest racism, racial injustice, and police brutality. The protest, which was obviously sparked by the May 25th death of George Floyd, lasted for about a half an hour in Tom Nivers and then moved to Main Street, where many knelt on the cobblestones for nearly 9 minutes, the length of time it's believed that the former Minneapolis police officer had his knee on Floyd's neck. The protest was organized by both current and former Nantucket High School students and led by three students who spoke to the Tom Nivers crowd, which most of whom were in their cars, many of whom had signs reading with statements like, "I can't breathe," "No justice, no peace," "Black Lives Matter." There were two moments during the Tom Nivers protest as well when those in attendance questioned the Nantucket Police Department's handling of recent cases involving black people on the island. One of the speakers brought up the vandalism of the African Meeting House in 2018 mm-hmm. when lewd and racist graffiti was spray-painted on the historic building. No arrests have been made in that case. That case was turned over to the state police for investigation by Nantucket police after allegations were made that the culprit was the child of a member of the police department. That case is still active, and there's been no new information on that. Speaking this week, Police Chief Nantucket Bill Pittman also acknowledged that his department, like so many in the nation, doesn't necessarily reflect the ethnic makeup of the community, which the department only has two minority officers. But he also said it's not for lack of trying. Underrepresented populations are hard to recruit into police departments, he said. Many of them, he believes, don't want to be police officers, and he says he doesn't want members of the community on his police force who don't want to be police officers.
Do you get a sense that there's going to be more rallies and protests on the island going forward?
That's a good question. We haven't heard of anything organized. This one came together rather quickly anyway. There are a number of signs, posters that we've seen around the island, many sharing the same sentiments as the signs that were held up in Tom Nivers, some larger. There were a couple of sort of bedsheet slogans downtown earlier this week as well. But at the moment, we haven't heard of any organized protests yet.
Let me ask you about another story you had this week. Nantucket is lagging far behind the state and the nation in its census response. What's going on here?
Well, that's a good question that the Census Committee out here is trying to figure out. The state average as of earlier this week was about 62% response, and the national average is about 60%, and Nantucket is all the way down at 23%. Martha Turk, who is the coordinator of the island's Census Complete Count Committee, isn't exactly sure why, but she has some suspicions. Part of the problem, she thinks, is the transient nature of much of Nantucket's population, maybe not spending the entire year on the island, and given the coronavirus pandemic, she wonders that whether some people haven't yet returned to the island yet. She also said that the high percentage of renters on the island might be keeping the response numbers down, even though everyone is obviously encouraged to fill out the census, whether they rent or own a home or not. Some of those things seem to bear out if you look at the response rate based on the location on the island. The Mid-Island area has about a 42% response rate, and that's where most year-round families live, compared to less than 10% on the east end of the island and about 14% in the downtown area. So it's, census takers have actually, though, begun dropping off questionnaires at houses that don't have street that don't get residential mail delivery, that have post office boxes, and Turk encourages everyone to go online and fill out the census. Obviously, it's important because it determines everything from political representation to federal and state funding. And if Nantucket is undercounted, that means less money and potentially less representation.
That is Josh Balling from the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror joining us this morning. Josh, thanks for that.
Thank you.
This is the local news roundup on The Point. I'm Steve Junker. Right now, we're going to talk with Noah Asimow at the Vineyard Gazette. Protesters gathered this week on Martha's Vineyard, too, and Noah has that story. Hi, Noah.
Hey, Steve. How you doing?
Noah, the Vineyard protest drew quite a crowd, more than 400 people.
Yeah, having been to a number of protests down at Five Corners, which is kind of like the general protest spot on the island, this one was by far the largest one that I've ever been to. And of course, it's coming sort of as protests are sweeping the nation in response to police brutality and racial injustice. And it was really an impressive turnout. And one of the coolest things about it was that it was organized by a 15-year-old at the high school, no less. And the crowd who was there was just, you know, generally different than the people who are showing up to a lot of protests on the Vineyard. It was a lot younger. You know, I think some summer residents are here. There were people who had come back from college, that kind of thing. And it was a diverse crowd, too. And it was an impressive and a powerful display to see.
And the crowd that turned out, this was on Monday, right? Just so people know when
yeah.
this was. They had this kind of peaceful rally, but they also did what many rallies have done now, which is to take a silence for the interval
right.
of time that George Floyd was held down by the Minneapolis police officer with his knee on his neck.
Yeah, and that, you know what, that was sort of the central part of the demonstration and event. Everyone took a knee for 8 minutes and 46 seconds, which is the exact amount of time that the knee was held on George Floyd's neck. And talking to people who were there after taking the knee, you know, I think one of the biggest takeaways was how actually uncomfortable it was to have your knee on the ground for 8 minutes and 46 seconds. And people thinking, well, that's a really long time to have your knee and, you know, to realize what you're doing. And second of all, you know, if I feel uncomfortable just having a knee on the ground, imagine the discomfort that someone would feel with that knee on their neck. And it was impressive to see all these people, you know, at a site that everyone drives through on the island, all taking a knee silent. Some cars would drive through and honk while it was happening, but people generally remained quiet just out of respect, even though the honks were also, you know, in support of what was going on. But it was an impressive and powerful moment. And talking to people after, it clearly had an impact.
There was an altercation
yeah.
towards the end of this. Tell us what happened.
Yeah, so there was an incident toward the end of the event. According to police reports and witness testimony from the scene, an individual in a red pickup truck used a racial slur and an obscene gesture with one of the demonstrators. A different demonstrator then said, "Hey, be respectful, man." And the guy ended up punching that individual. And then police came over. They didn't see any of that occur, but then they came over, and this kind of happened off to the side of the event and toward in near the end of it. And after police were sort of assessing the situation, another individual threw a rock through the man's truck window. And what ended up happening was, you know, at that point, there were a lot of people around. There was a lot of commotion, but both people were arrested. They were taken to jail, and sort of everything was peacefully dispersed at that point, which I think was important. And you know, it was, I think the takeaway there was that everything didn't escalate beyond that, and there was this appropriate police response. And, you know, it shows the importance of being involved in your own community as well, you know, even if it is in a big city.
Noah Asmo from the Vineyard Gazette, thanks for joining us. State lawmakers have not been silent amid the unrolling wave of protests and rallies locally and across the world. WCAI's Catherine Iden talked with State House reporter Mike Dean about some of the proposals lawmakers might consider.
Good morning, Mike.
Hey, good morning, Catherine.
I want to get first right away to a group of lawmakers who not only spoke out this week, they presented some possible legislation that lawmakers could get on the table right away. And they did that by starting out with a march on Tuesday.
Yeah, it was about a dozen or so you know, Black and Latino elected officials and some allies as well, you know, marched from the Museum of African American History in Beacon Hill, marched over to the steps of the State House in silence, and then held another 8 or 9 minute moment of silence for George Floyd to kind of set the tone for what they were doing. But the whole point here was to really get their 10-point plan across for what they want to see changed. Three of them are at the federal level. Congresswoman Ayanna Pressley was there. She's the author of many of the efforts on the federal level that she's trying to get through Congress, that the House is potentially going to take up. And then there are five or six measures at the state level, and then some at the municipal level that are really the meat of what Beacon Hill is being asked to deal with now. And it really has to do with police oversight, transparency, and accountability. One of the major things that they're looking at is to have state standards and training for all peace officers in the Commonwealth, and especially to have a certification process that can then be revoked if an officer fails the standards or if there are incidents, civilian oversight of racial incidents. They're really looking for very specific changes to the law as we go forward to articulate some of the unrest that we're seeing.
There has been some criticism of House Speaker Robert DeLeo saying that he has not been very active in addressing racial injustices even before these latest rounds of protest. How did he react, or did he react, to the message that lawmakers sent?
DeLeo watched the demonstration, the rally, and the press conference that followed live streaming at the invitation of the activists behind it. You got to remember, we're still in a COVID-19 pandemic. And he said that he's committed to enacting the criminal justice bill that was passed a few years ago, fully getting that up to speed. And he said he's meeting with the Black and Latino Caucus and some other stakeholders. He was ID'd as one of the impediments to these things in the past, and it's important to note that almost all of these bills have been filed year after year after year. These are not new ideas. Senate President Karen Spilka also hasn't passed these, it should be known, but she was there in person and stood with the demonstrators. She didn't actually say anything, so we don't actually know if she is going to go along the way DeLeo is with stakeholders and speak with folks. The Senate's kind of considered the more progressive body of the two. And Governor Baker himself has said kind of similar things. He's meeting with the Black and Latino Caucus. He's having talks with stakeholders. So, you know, the big three, as we call them, on Beacon Hill seem to be aligned somewhere that they want to get something done. What and when are always the big questions when it comes to state politics and policy.
Speaking of the governor, he also spoke out this week with some harsh words about the president's photo op in front of a church that had to be forcibly cleared of protesters.
Yeah, it's rare that Governor Baker really strongly condemns President Trump. You know, he's a Republican. He sees his Republican status as one of the few things that gets Massachusetts any kind of help and aid from the federal government because, you know, the delegation is all Democratic and we have some of the more progressive, you know, U.S. senators So Baker has always kind of been, I guess, protective of the relationship with the White House. I'll put it that way. After that Lafayette Park incident and the Rose Garden press conference, you know, Baker really had some strong words. The strongest thing he said is that, you know, many times over the last several weeks, when the nation needed it most, compassion and leadership were nowhere to be found, which is really a straight shot at the Trump administration. He said, instead of leadership, the nation got bitterness, combativeness, and self-interest. It went down fairly well on the left and the middle in Massachusetts. You know, some of the pro-Trump Republican Party didn't like it very much. But Baker, I think, knows where the votes are in Massachusetts, certainly. And that's, you know, a statement that he makes is rare, but when he says it, it does cause waves.
Baker also commented on the protests, mainly in the city of Boston. They've been mostly peaceful, but there was some violence and some looting earlier this week.
Baker's message was actually very similar to what we're hearing from a lot of mayors and governors of either party, really across the country. And that is a distinction between the thousands that are coming out for peaceful protests, especially during the day and into the evening, and then violence and looting and rioting that happens after that curfew. Making the distinction between the two and expressing that, yes, some of the violence and destruction might undermine the message of the peaceful protesters, but it doesn't completely undermine it, and that the message is still very, very strong. He thanked police, and he called the violence and looting criminal and cowardly, said that those individuals who are, you know, doing acts of destruction will have their day in court. But he then went to reinforce the message of these demonstrators to say Black Lives Do Matter and to commit to working with the Black and Latino Caucus, other elected officials of color, other members, other stakeholders, to really draw up some kind of package for reforming how policing is conducted in Massachusetts.
And finally, Mike, we are still in a pandemic and we are looking toward phase two of the governor's reopening plan. That includes things like retail shops, restaurants, daycares. Do you have an idea of what else we can expect?
Well, we're going to find out tomorrow, because on Saturday, Governor Baker is going to say whether or not phase two is going to start next week and then allow businesses to prepare for a few days before they open their doors. Now, of course, they don't have to open their doors. It's all voluntary. And of course, he's tracking public health data and statistics, really the trends that we've been looking at throughout this entire saga. There are strong indicators that he will start phase two, and we'll definitely see, you know, when restaurants, daycare centers, summer camps, hotels, that is going to be something that Baker will address. That guidance has already been put online, so business owners can prepare already, and then Baker should give the go-ahead or the un-go-ahead on Saturday.
And that is Mike Dean, WCAI State House reporter. Mike, thanks. Have a great weekend.
Thanks, Catherine. You too.
And that was WCAI's Catherine Iden speaking with Mike Dean, our State House reporter. This is the News Roundup on The Point. I'm Steve Junker. Right now, we're going to speak with WCAI's Eve Zuckoff, who rejoins us to talk about some environmental news. Hi, Eve.
Hi, Steve.
Eve, thanks for coming back on the program. We had you in the beginning talking about protests. I wanted to ask you about another story you covered this week. And it's a first-of-its-kind project that's been some time in the making. It's an environmental project, and it has to do with the Outer Cape towns working together. Explain for us what's happening here.
That's exactly right, and I am happy to be back. It's basically what the four out of Outer Cape towns are looking at here is how can we develop a more resilient coastline, specifically to the forces of climate change. And the lead on this is a man named Mark Borelli. He's a coastal geologist with the Center for Coastal Studies. And the way he describes it is, I think in sand. And that's kind of what they're doing. They're taking all four towns, they're looking up and down the coastline, and instead of, you know, monitoring municipal boundaries to create plans in Truro and plans in Eastham, they're saying, when it comes to coastal management, can we treat this as one single body? Because to the planet, it is. Environmentally, it is. You know, there's no municipal boundaries in nature. So what they're doing is they're looking at things like, where are our barrier beaches, our salt marshes, our coastal dunes, our bluffs? And also, where are our houses? Where is our federally owned land? And they're mapping all of this to try to figure out, you know, they spent the last year actually mapping what is the scheme? What are we looking at here? And the goal going into next year, they're just, you know, filing for more grant money right now, is to look at, can we develop a plan to figure out where we might dredge in this year in this town and where we might move that sand to, because there's going to be a sand-starved beach in another town that before the sand wouldn't go there. Everything was done at a town level. So, that, you know, towns often, two towns will work together over a natural resource, but never have four towns come together to do something like this in the state of Massachusetts.
So this does represent quite a step forward in terms of environmental planning. Now, you said that this past year they've been essentially mapping and getting a sense of the state of the coastline as it is and what its vulnerabilities are in the face of climate change. And as they apply for grants to go forward, what kinds of what are the positives that they can see in working together and making this come together? And what kinds of projects are they looking at?
Yeah, so for the most part, they're looking at, one of the main things they're looking at is larger beach nourishment projects. So if you dredge a harbor down in Truro, you know, what can you do with all that sand? How can you actually examine that? And then also cost savings, you know, the economies of scale here. If you have all four towns throwing their resources behind this, you're going to be able to save some money potentially. Also, when four towns apply for a grant, there are a lot more opportunities there. Another benefit of this is just increased resiliency when it comes to coastal infrastructure and protection. That's, I think, the main one. I mean, they're really looking at the way that sea level rise and erosion are changing our coastline here, as kind of the major forces of climate change that affect this region. And they're saying there's actually something we can do if we work together to appropriately manage the really limited resource that is sand. Mm-hmm.
That is WCAI's environment and climate change reporter, Eve Zuckoff. Eve, thanks for joining us with that.
Thank you, Steve.
That is our show for today. I want to thank my guests. We heard from Eve Zuckoff and WCAI's Jeanette Barnes. We spoke with Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle, Alex Darris at the Provincetown Banner, and Jessica Hill at the Cape Cod Times. We checked in with Josh Balling at the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror, and Noah Asimo at the Vineyard Gazette. And we heard from Mike Dean up at the State House speaking with Catherine Ident. A big thanks to Dan Tridle back at the studio, patching everything together when it starts to teeter. And thanks to my family for approximating a state of suspended animation for the past hour. From my home in Woods Hole, I'm Steve Junker. Thank you for listening.